I'm Jason Klom, and this is Comedy on Vinyl. The year, several albums, various artists, also various. We've got a lot to talk about. This week, my guest is part of my favorite album that I've been introduced to in these 10 years on the show. That album is A Great White North. My guest, Dave Thomas, thank you so much for being here.
Pleasure. Pleasure to be here.
Now, I love that you agreed to do it, but I also love that you have a very specific reason for picking the things you picked. One of the things you said was The Best of Peter Sellers, which is a fun album. I have heard that one. The other one is this mysterious but well-remembered Andy Griffith track that you should just tell me about, because it's a part of your life story. So tell me a bit about where you first heard it and why you memorized a bunch of it as a kid.
Well, my dad was the one who would play these comedy albums and laugh his ass off. And he would play them repeatedly, and he would repeat lines from them that amused him. And this particular Andy Griffith cut was about Andy and his family going down to Florida from North Carolina on Number 1 Street, which was U.S. Route 1. And that is something that my family had done. And so literally all of the bits in this album are things that we remember from this trip. There was one where he said, "We saw a sign, free picnic tables 1 mile." And I said, "Well, let's stop and get us one." Well, we kind of wish we had waited till we was on the way back, being as it was made of concrete and all. That was just, I thought, a great joke.
Of course.
Especially back then. Then there's the bit that I know some other people remember. When you actually get to Florida, there was just like, back then, this was in the late 50s. All the orange juice you can drink for 10 cents.
Okay.
And he said, "I saw that wee scar car screech to a halt. We pulled up there and I went in there and I said to that fella, I'd like a big glass of orange juice." And he said, "Coming right up." And he said, "That'll be a dime." And I put my dime down on the table and I drank her down. And then I said to him, "I believe I'd like another one." And he said, "Well, that'd be another dime." And he said, well, wait, your son said all the orange juice you can drink for a dime." He said, "Well, one glass is all you can drink for a dime." And that was his joke. That was pretty stupid, but funny.
It's great, though. It's great. It's perfect. Like, it is this, you know, obviously Southern tinged, which it could be told in any accent, but it doesn't hurt with that particular North Carolina.
Canadians who had moved to Durham. My dad was at Duke in the philosophy department, and my mother was in the psychology department, which at that time had the famous parapsychologist Dr. Ryan and Dr. Zehner. She was specifically Zehner's secretary assistant, and he created what are known as the Zehner cards that are actually used in Ghostbusters. They're cards that have a triangle, a circle, four wavy lines, a square, and the purpose is that the one person on the desk would hold up a card, on one side of the desk would hold up a card, and the other person was responsible for guessing which card that was. And there was sort of like laws of statistics and probability that predicted what random would be and what a uncanny ability to predict these cards would be. And so they used them. Ryan used them in his experiments. Zehner was more of a traditional psychologist. Ryan was a real leading edge experimental psychologist in parapsychology. But they were partners. And they had in the basement, the psychology lab we lived on Markham Avenue, which was right across from Duke in the faculty apartments there, which were horrible. But the psychology lab was right across the street from our apartment. So Ian and my brother and I would cross the road climb this little wall. It was a short wall, and then go to the psychology lab where my mom was working. And in the basement, they had all these animals for experiments, cats and dogs and birds and things like that with their heads shaved and electrodes in their heads.
Oh, my
God. It
was
really horrible for a little kid to see this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we're a couple of Canadian kids that our parents bring down from Toronto to Durham. And it's severe culture shock for us.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I was there really for my formative years.
Mm-hmm.
Grammar school from the age of 6 to 12, you know. So I became a Southerner. You can't live there and go to school there.
Right.
At first Moorhead, then George Watts Public School, without becoming a Southerner.
That makes sense.
And for a while, you get tormented because you're from the North. And you, Yankee, is that what you are? You're a Yankee, aren't you? And I was very, very specific. I said, no, I'm a Canadian. I'm not even from this country. We weren't in the Civil War, you know, because mm-hmm. they were still fighting it back then.
Right.
So Andy Griffith's specific rural comedy. We went to see the movie No Time for Sergeants when we were mm-hmm. down there. And became huge fans before the television show that really made him famous even came on the air, you know. Mm-hmm. Simultaneously wow. with that, because my father was born in Wales and my mother was born in Scotland, there was a big British comedy influence.
Mm-hmm.
So the Goons were a big part of my influence, and specifically Peter Sellers, who was just, I thought, vocally brilliant.
Yeah.
The stuff he could do with his voice as a little kid, I was like, oh, wait, that's not him. That can't be him. You know?
Yeah.
And there were jokes on that album. There's one fake documentary called Balham Gateway to the South.
Yeah.
So it's got a narrator that's, I think it's Sellers.
I think it is. Positive. Yeah. I get thrown every time, but I'm like, I think it has to be.
Balham. And he's got that kind of American. It was always really difficult for Brits to do American dialects.
Uh-huh.
And you would see it in film and you'd go, oh, piss off. That's pathetic, you know. But Sellers was really good at it, you know. Mm. And he had it down in Dr. Strangelove, yeah. And he had it down on this Balham Gateway to the South. But all the jokes are British jokes. They're not American jokes.
Yeah.
And we had been to Britain every summer.
Okay.
So we got these jokes. And he goes to at one point when he's in Balham, he goes out for a little nightlife and goes to the El Morocco tea room.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, I live the Pilchers. And she says, they're off, dear. He says, shame. I was kind of feeling, I kind of wanted them. Well, I'll have the baked beans on time. No baked beans, darling, it's off. And so everything he asked for is mm-hmm. off.
Mm-hmm.
And we were in Britain as little kids, and we would go out to restaurants with my parents, and half the stuff on the menu would be off. It would be like, that never happened in the United States, you know?
Funny.
It was just, it's off. And when somebody would say it was off, we would remember this cut from Balham, and my brother and I would just be doubling up and dying, you know? Then there's the interview with the rock star, Twit Conway.
Yeah.
And the Major, mm-hmm. which is, it's so British, you know? The
yeah.
Major is his manager. And he's got one of these voices like Peter Sellers like to do, you know, that kind of voice. And he's like, my blue jeans are so tight. I mean, why you cut the knees out and just ink in where the flesh shows? You know, there were so many stupid but hilariously funny jokes
mm-hmm.
in that cut. Then there's a song that's like Steve Lawrence.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So you got me swinging all the time.
Mm-hmm.
My head is spinning. My ears are ringing. You got me dangling on a line. You keep me swinging all the time. Say yay or nay, dear. But either way, dear, we please won't you make up your sweet mind. So I listened to this and I thought, that can't be Sellers. And it was.
Right.
And it was like, holy shit. So he was my comic idol. And my way into comedy was vocal.
Yeah.
It was dialects and accents and characters. And I could do, because we traveled to Britain every summer to visit relatives, I could do Scottish and Welsh and English dialects. And because we'd grown up in the South, I could do Southern dialects. And because I had, after I was 12 years old, we went back to Canada, and all of a sudden those, get out, eh? That Canadian oot and about, that Canadian dialect, that, I'm listening to it. And it's very, very pronounced in Ottawa, the Rideau Canal dialect in Canada is very specific. These are all the people in government, you know. Oh, back to the Peter Sellers record.
Sure.
There's another thing where I think it's in the Balham, and there's a park where people get up on soapboxes and speak.
Uh-huh.
And there's a point at which this woman shouts, what about the workers? Because that's, you know, the labor movement in Britain was really big, and it was always labor versus the Tories, you know.
Sure, yeah.
And, so we're at the place in Great Britain called the Bullring, which is a place like that in Birmingham, England, where my father's parents were living at the time. They were from Wales originally, and then they moved there during World War II because my grandfather worked in the British small arms factory. So anyway, we're at the Bullring in Birmingham, England. And we're watching this guy on a soapbox, and it's just like people are shouting out. And so I'm like 13 or something, 12. And I shout out from the crowd, what about the workers? Just as a joke from the album, the Peter Sellers album. And this woman turns around in front of me and she says, he's for the workers. If you had been listening, you would have known that, you know. And it was just,
holy shit.
The borderline between reality and comedy dissolved for us when we were able to go to Britain and experience that.
Yeah.
The reality of what went on there, you know? I'm trying to remember some of the other cuts on that Peter Sellers.
I can read you off the track list if you want.
Oh, yeah, do that.
Okay, so side A, track one, is the trumpet volunteer.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So this is like a very strange thing because my mother was also a musician and played organ in churches every Sunday taught students. And so Purcell's trumpet voluntary is a famous classical British piece that they play in churches, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so they turn it into a rock song on this cut. So it's to the tune of Purcell's trumpet voluntary, and it's rock, rock, everybody rock. And I can't remember the rest of it, but it's to the down, down, to the trumpet voluntary rock, something like that. And we just thought that was hilarious because it was a smart piece. That you need to have a classical background to be able to do, you know. What's the next cut?
Anti-Rotter.
Oh, this is just a song. Up on the chair behind the door, I take out my chopper. He opens the door and cut him in two. Something like that. But it was a children's show thing that was extremely violent. And I ended up using that on SCTV because instead of Captain Kangaroo, played by Bob Keeshan, I played Captain Combat, who was like a military guy and made him really violent. And what's the next cut?
All the Things You Are.
Oh, this is just a great... You are... the promised breath of springtime. Da 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 da. I don't have the voice anymore. You are the angel glow that lights the sky, and all the things you are, and all the things I love, are what you are. You are the promised breath of springtime. So these are, we not only listened to this, we learned these songs and sang them around the house, you know? Mm-hmm. My dad would sing them, and my mom would sing them. What's the next cut?
And if I'm not mistaken, that last one, it becomes obvious that he's a janitor, like, in a bathroom, and that's why the acoustics are so good. If I remember, the next one is We Need the Money.
What's it?
We Need the Money, but I can't remember what that is off the top
of
my head.
I can't remember that one either.
It's been a minute since I've listened to it. But the next cut after that is I'm So Ashamed, which is the first track of B.
So that's the teen, that's the rocker.
Oh, yes, there we are.
I'm So Ashamed. My album's a flop. I haven't got a record in the top 20 pop.
That's right.
And
isn't he like 9 years old? Isn't that part of the gag? Yeah. Supposed to be very young. There we go. Okay. Then Party Political Speech is the next one, which.
So that's at what would be the version of the Birmingham's Bullring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Balaam
and,
Gate.
And here's
to the
an
sound.
Interesting thing.
Yes.
The British have, you know, several dialects, even compartmentalized, say in England, you know, you've got the north of England where drop articles and come round for supper, me and family and mum, you know, it's a very, and then there's this political speeches where they take words and they elongate them slightly, like responsibility. That's one of the words that I when I was listening to that album, I was like, oh, right. I remember hearing that when I was over there, you know. What's the next cut?
The next one's Balaam, Gateway to the South.
Balham, yeah.
And then
another cut on that where you hear this insane piano playing. Mm-hmm. And my mother had a revival sort of evangelical style of piano playing, which was overly chorded and overly. My brother turned out to be a musician and did, you know, 20 albums and different bands and things like that. And he's still working. He's still doing them. Still selling too. But our joke was that, and it's from this album, the guy's name who plays this discordant piano is called Leonard Quills. And it's like so enamored and so dedicated to the work of Leonard's piano playing are the citizens of Balham that they're taking up a collection to send him to Paris or Rome or Vienna or anywhere. Do you know what I mean?
I love it.
So we used to do that joke. My brother and I would do that joke that my mom was Leonard Quills. So there's the fish and chip shop in there. There's El Morocco Tea Room in Balham. There's Leonard Quills. There's the lights changing from the fairyland of lights at night, changing from red to amber to green, back to amber. And red again. It's obviously a stoplight.
Love it.
It's just, you know, subtle but funny, we thought. Anyway.
Yeah. There are a few things I want to go back to because I'm always curious as to, like, how, you know, how exposed people were to comedy. Obviously, your parents must have had a bunch. Did they have a bunch of comedy records sitting around in the house or just these select few? Okay. They were big.
Tom Lehrer.
Mm-hmm.
We had his records.
Sure.
Swan and Flanders.
Oh, yeah.
You know them?
Sure. Uh-huh.
Beyond the Fringe,
of course.
Obviously. Well, Andy Griffith, Jonathan Winters.
Mm-hmm.
It was comedy school.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, if you had these albums, oh, and who is the guy? Victor Borge.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah.
So, and he was a combination of, you know, piano playing, which was my mom, and she loved him.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I'm sure there are others, but those are the ones I can remember right off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, wait, Spike Jones.
Oh, of course.
And, you know, all of his versions of songs,
mm-hmm,
with, you know, explosions and gunshots and firecrackers and kazoos and things like that. They were hilarious and part of my upbringing.
Were there family nights? What did you do when you listened to them? Or when did you listen to these together?
So my dad was a philosophy professor.
Mm-hmm.
And he would have people over who were like, you know, psychologists and philosophers. Some of the psychologists from my mother's department.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, there would be food. And then there would be sitting around in the living room putting on these albums and everybody laughing at the albums. So they were, you know, they were a presentational part of the family package, you know,
yeah,
where, and the fact that I could do some of the dialects and some of the cuts was particularly amusing to my father's friends. And I became kind of dad's little puppet there, you know, because I could do these characters from the albums, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've forgotten a lot of them now. Like, I used to be able to do all these songs, you know, and I was stumbling my way through lyrics, but I used to be able to do them all verbatim, you know.
Sure. I mean, when you're a kid, that is one of those weird sort of, one of the things you can count on is that record you can go back to, or nowadays it might be a movie or a TV show you can stream and go back to, but then it was a record. That's the only permanent bit of media you would have available to you, so why would you not?
And I mean, we saw him do this on TV, but he also did it on a record.
Mm-hmm.
Jonathan Winters used to do, I think he did a different version on record, but he used to do this pitcher,
mm-hmm,
on the mound, chewing gum, and he would do the throw for the ball and the sound of the ball being going through the air and hitting the catcher's mitt.
Uh-huh.
And the sound of a hit, the sound of a, and the baseball, he could do pops with his mouth that were, you know, only dreams and fantasies for people like me that were trying,
sure,
to do. His sound effects skills. And he was the first. You know, there were a bunch of sound effects comedians that came later,
mm-hmm,
with the conceptual crowd, like Robert Klein and people,
sure,
like that. Jonathan Winters was the first sound effects comedian we ever heard.
Yeah.
You know, and he would do the catcher throwing the ball back to him, and he would do a sound of it being caught in his glove that was just, it was just perfect.
Crazy.
It was something that we would listen to it and go, put and lift the needle, you know, play that back. I want to hear that again, you know.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know if you're aware of this, but sometime, oh wait, when is it? It's late June. It's late May. Sometime, Record Store Day next month, there's a 3 LP Jonathan Winters record coming out that has a bunch of unreleased stuff on it that promises to be pretty good. I haven't listened to all of it yet. I have the digital version because they gave me a preview of it, but there's a lot of really good Jonathan Winters stuff on it, including on his second record, they cut out a lot of him talking about being committed, and they cut out most of his references to it. And this has all that stuff put back in. So way more stuff about being in the nut house, as it were.
Well, I met him and worked with him.
Uh-huh.
I did a special with him called Jonathan Winters Salute to Baseball.
Uh-huh.
And he came up to, this was shot in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
I was just starting out. And there was one point, I played this popcorn vendor and I had a couple of scenes with him.
Mm-hmm.
There was just one point where there were bleachers that were put in a TV studio So they kind of ended, and there was a railing there so people didn't fall off.
Sure.
And the railing, he was leaning against the railing at the end of the bleachers, just having taken a break in a moment by himself. And I just walked up to him and I said, "You ever seen the water this smooth before, Captain?" And he looks at me and he goes, "Well, let me tell you something about water, son," and goes into a bit. And all of a sudden, I am doing a straight man for a bit with Jonathan Winters.
Holy
in
shit.
Real life. And all I did, because I knew he's like a lawnmower, you know, you just ring, ding, 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 ding. You just start him and he goes. And all he needed was that first line, which was, it looked like the railing of a ship. And all you needed was somebody to come up and trigger him, and he went. And then I was his buddy after that, because anybody that can play with him was his buddy. He was very, he reminded me of John Candy. John Candy was a lot like Jonathan Winters.
Really?
And yeah, they were both little kids who never really grew up, mm-hmm. you know, and they got bigger and the world got bigger and they didn't grow up, you know?
Yeah.
Here's a classic example with John Candy. We were shooting a scene on SCTV called Harry Filth.
Mm-hmm.
And John was Harry Filth, and the joke was he needs a bigger gun. He comes in, I'll need a bigger gun. But the very first scene starts in a 7-Eleven, and it's a robbery in there, and Harry moves in and goes to shoot them. And John moves in, he's got this gun, like a blank gun, and mm-hmm. John's got the gun, and he goes making the gun sound effect with his mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And I am in the scene and I just burst out laughing. And everyone's cut, cut. John, the gun has blanks. You can pull the trigger. And I was saying, no. He still thinks he's playing guns when he was a little kid. And he's making the noise with his mouth, you know?
Holy shit.
I mean, and Jonathan Winters was like that. Mm-hmm. I could see that. I think it only... It was like a 2-day or 3-day shoot for this mm-hmm. suit of baseball. But I didn't have time with him, but I got his MO, and it was very, very similar to John Candy's, you know?
Yeah.
And
I love that.
He was talking at one point, Winters was talking about being in World War II. He was a soldier in World War II.
Oh, yeah, right.
And he was told by his commanding officer that they were supposed to take this hill.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant a lot of men... we're going to die going up this hill, because there's these Japanese at the top of the hill with a machine gun just mowing people down. I was talking to Winters, and he was saying that his commanding officer told him to take the hill. And he was like, "I'm not taking the hill. We're not doing that. We're all going to get killed. And who gives a shit about that hill? How important is that hill to us here? It's not important at all. I'm not doing it." And he wouldn't do it. And he said, and I said, "So what happened? Did you get disciplinary action? Did you get put up in charges?" And he said, "No." He said, he knew it was bullshit too. And somebody had told him that he had to tell us that. And he's just like, "All right, well, let's just, we'll hang here until something happens. And then we'll react to that."
Holy shit.
But it was really... imagining Jonathan Winters in a real war with real guns, having to do real heavy lifting and soldiering, it's beyond belief. It's not right. Yeah. That shows you how wrong the world can get sometimes, you know,
mm-hmm.
because there's this big jovial kid with a chubby, lovable face that can do sound effects of baseballs hitting gloves is now suddenly given an M1 carbine and put into the jungle and told to shoot other people. Mm-hmm. That's not right. That's just nuts.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Wow. And
anyway, between that, I don't think Bob Hope ever did any records, did he?
You know what? I was curious about that today myself for obvious reasons, because I was going to ask you if you'd ever met him. But other than like, you know, recordings of his old radio shows and shit like that, I'm assuming there's nothing. Wait, what is this? Hold on. I could be wrong. No, see, these are broadcasts. They're just reprints of recuts of old broadcasts to the military and stuff. There's nothing dedicated that was like, I'm going to make an album.
Yeah.
I don't think. Yeah.
Well, I mean, he didn't have time, I guess, you know.
Right.
I
mean, busy guy.
I met him a number of times. I worked with him. I did his special. I did his 90th birthday special.
Okay.
With Chester Hope.
Mm-hmm.
One of his relatives. And that's a typical Bob Hope thing, too. There was a while there where he would just change his last name, but his character in a movie would still have the name Bob.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So he would be Bob Hooper or Bob Harp or, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that people would just be able to call him Bob. And he just did that because he was so lazy.
Yeah.
And he couldn't be bothered to respond to another name, you know. And
he was like the original comedy raconteur, though, right? I mean, he just didn't stop, I feel like.
No. And I remember I got a call when I was doing Grace Under Fire. And we shot that at CBS Radford, which is near Bob's house in Toluca Lake.
Oh, sure, yeah.
So I got a call from his publicist, Ward Grant. And he said, Bob wants you to come over to the house. And I said, I'm on my way. I mean, Bob Hope wants you to come over to the house. I didn't care if we were rehearsing or I'd get in trouble or what. I got my car and I drove over there. And when I got there, Ward met me at the door. And he said, he's upstairs outside his bedroom in this. He's got a little makeup area there that he uses so he doesn't have to go and get made up at NBC.
Mm-hmm.
So I went up the stairs, and as I came up the stairs, he's like sitting in front of this makeup mirror, not really putting makeup on or anything, just looking at his own face. And he turns and he sees me. He says, oh, hi, Dave, what are you doing here? And I said, well, Ward said that you wanted me to come over. And he just kind of looks at me. He goes, yeah, well, what do you want? So I knew that you don't get in it. He was like 89 or something at that point.
Uh-huh.
Get into it with an 89-year-old man and go, no, Ward said you, and now you're asking me what I just said to him, I want to see that picture you have of General Patton pissing in the Rhine. And I'd heard about this, that he had this photo.
Okay.
And the minute I said that to him, he lit up like a Christmas tree, and he goes, you heard about that? Come here, I'll show you. And so we're walking down the hallway outside his bedroom, and he's got all these photos on the walls. He said, you know, that there were three of these pictures. Patton said he would cut a swath through Hitler's Europe. And then he'd piss in his Rhine, and I got a pic of him doing it. He said, you know, the family, they wanted him back. And they got the other two. But I said, no, you're never getting this one. And then he showed me, and there's a picture of General Patton with his twin Colts on his pistols on his hip, taking a piss in the Rhine.
Holy shit.
And then right beside it, he says, even Hope goes, he says, yeah, this is Neil Armstrong. He did my special right after he got back from the moon. And, I mean, who else could say that?
No, you know, one. Good God.
Guy goes to the moon. Next up, Bob Hope special.
Here's a picture of Neil Armstrong pissing on the moon. Look at that. Bob's got everything on his wall.
I'll show you something he gave me. Hold on one second.
Okay, sure.
So one of his writers said, Bob Mills, one of Bob Hope's writers said, he was legendarily cheap.
Mm-hmm.
He said he paid all of us a lot of money as writers. But he was really, really cheap. And if you ever asked him for anything, he would clam up, you know. He didn't. And he said they were at his, he had this little house. It was in this little house. It was like a guest house outside of his main house in Toluca Lake. And that was his office where he worked with his writers.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to leave there and go play golf. And Bob had golf clubs and golf sets and golf balls just given to him for all the different Bob Hope Desert Classics and things
sure,
like that that he
yeah.
did. So his place was just, it was like a golf pro shop. It was just jammed with stuff.
Uh-huh.
And one of the writers said to him, there was like a little box of golf balls. So, you know, like six balls in a
sure.
box. He said, "Hey, Bob, you mind if I take this box of balls? I don't have any balls." And Hope looks at me and says, "Well, you can get those in the clubhouse, you know. You don't have to take mine." So anyway, I knew better than to ask him for anything. Mm-hmm. And we were looking around in his at the memorabilia, and he had amazing stuff in that office.
I bet.
We come across this, which is a golf club that has,
oh my God,
the famous Bob Hope.
That's insane.
It's a putter.
Yeah.
And I looked at this and I just burst out laughing. I said,
"His face is on it."
You know you've made it when you've got your own putter with your own ski jump nose silhouette on it.
Uh-huh.
And he laughed and he said, "You want that?" And I said, I can't take it. He said, No, I got more. He said, take it. And he uh-huh. gave it to me.
I love it. That's so.
I got this.
That's friggin' beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That's a solid piece of metal too. That is not cheap anything. That's beautiful. I am not a golfer, but I love it.
And it's autographed too.
That's so good. That's so good. Yeah, that's beautiful. Wow. Oh.
It's etched right into the metal.
Wow.
I mean, here's the story of Dave Thomas and Vinyl.
Mm-hmm.
Vinyl launched my comedy career. It was where I got the references that I was able to use later that got me into Second City, and Second City launched my comedy career.
Mm-hmm.
And if it hadn't been for Vinyl, I never would have had a comedy career, because I basically went to comedy school with these records mm-hmm. that my dad would play for his professor friends. And we were in an academic family. I mean, you know, that was the world that I grew up in. But comedy was an important part of that for my dad anyway. He loved to laugh.
Yeah.
And he loved smart comedy, you know. And I think I inherited that for sure, that I love to laugh and I like doing comedy. And sometimes I'll write things or do things that are too smart for the room, you know, and it's just sure. like, yeah, forget it. You know, nobody's going to laugh at this.
Right.
And I would get into trouble a lot in the early days, because in the early days, the studios were much more, and the television networks were much more common denominator oriented.
Sure. Yeah.
Today, they understand shows like The Simpsons have showed them that you can do references that are smart as long as you do other stuff that's broader and more accessible with it.
Sure.
Then what you're doing is you're creating a comedy that shoots over a very wide spectrum and really pulls everybody in. That's mm-hmm. how it was able to become such a successful family show. And then it took a bit of doing, but finally that got hammered into the boneheaded executives that finally figured, okay, we don't have to downgrade everything to the lowest common denominator to make it accessible to the audience. We can do some smart stuff too, you know?
Yeah.
So, but in the early days, I would write either things that were too dark or too smart for the room.
Yeah.
I wrote a piece for SCTV called Pocket Pal. And it was a little KTEL product that gave you 15 seconds advance warning of a mid-air collision on an airplane. Just like, of all the stupid things that you could get, and the premise was that you're able to shout and tell everybody, "We're about to collide with another airplane," and then start screaming in advance of it happening.
Advance.
So anyway, Bernie Solms, who was actually running SCTV at that time when it was Second City Television, he said, "No, it's too dark. People are dying plane crashes. They're not going to like that. You know, you can't do that." And I was telling Dan Aykroyd about it. Danny's like, what the fuck? That's a great idea. I'll do it. Give it to me. I'll put it on Saturday Night Live. You'll be the first non-staff writer to get a piece on the show.
Uh-huh.
And I gave it to Dan, and Dan did it on SNL.
Holy shit.
You can find, I think, the Pocket Pal somewhere out there.
Good Christ.
On YouTube.
Wow.
So, but these cuts on the Peter Sellers, some of them were dark. Some of the stuff in the Goons was very dark, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
how and where did you hear the Goons? Were they from records, or was Canada playing them on the radio at the time?
No, they're from records.
Okay, all right.
Yeah,
I wondered, because I know they did a lot of compilations of their sketches and stuff in record form, so I was curious.
The CBC did play versions of it, but it was records.
Okay.
They didn't do broadcasts, you know.
Okay.
And it would have been recordings of broadcasts rather than actual simulcasting or broadcasts. But Peter Sellers was a minor character in the Goons. He mm-hmm. I mean, he played a fly. You know what I mean? He played Bottle or whatever. And Spike Milligan was really more of the star of the Goons than Peter was. But but it was sort of like, you know, I always thought that in Monty Python, John Cleese got all the attention. But I always thought Michael Palin was kind of... He didn't get quite as appreciated as Cleese, because Cleese did the silly walks and the bigger, broader stuff.
Right.
But Palin was a fucking genius. He was so good.
No doubt about it. No doubt about it.
And what he could do, I knew when I saw him that he was from the Sellers School,
mm-hmm.
because he did the voices. You know, a lot of comedians start with the voice and work their way out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first I'll get the voice of this character and play a certain way. And then once I get that voice, I'll find the mannerisms that accompany that voice. And then soon I'll have it, you know, and rah, rah, it'll be there. So I think that you always recognize the mechanics of what someone is doing when they're doing what you love and admire, you know. It's funny, I worked with Cleese on Rat Race.
Oh yeah.
I got to meet him and make him laugh, and that made me so happy.
Mm-hmm.
I know Eric Idle fairly well, and I've spent time with him.
Mm-hmm.
But I never met Palin. Never met him.
This could be just completely out of nowhere, but I feel like he might be very incredibly private. He seems like a quiet, private man, and I don't know if that's true, but he doesn't seem like a guy who gets out.
That makes sense.
You know? He's the guy who shines on stage for sure, but then goes off stage and is just like, I'm going to go home and have some tea.
John Cleese is quite mad, you know? Oh. I don't know if... did they ever do an album?
Oh, my goodness. You know, this is sacrilege to some, but I think their albums are better than the show.
Oh, yes. There's one album, and it's the four Yorkshiremen talking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, when I was a kid, we had it tough, you know? And that, to me, what was the most brilliant about that sketch was the button. On that, which is the very end of a comedy sketch, which it just puts the bow on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the chance to ask Cleese about this, like, whose idea was the button on that? And he goes, well, I like to think it was my idea, you know, because most of the good ideas were mine. But the button, if you'll recall, is it goes through absurd exaggerations of how tough they have it, to the point of, luxury, we lived in a paper bag on the corner of the street. When our dad came home, he would set a bloody bag on fire, stomp us to death. You know, it becomes really, really bizarre. And then at the very last guy to go was Eric Idle.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes round the horn and he's last. And then he goes, right. Before he starts, he goes, you pricks have made this really hard for me. I'm going to have to go real big. And that right spoke volumes.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of his bit, which went really far and it was hysterically funny, there's a pause. And I think it was Terry Jones, mm-hmm. who said, And you tell the bloody kids that these days, and they don't bloody believe you. You know,
yeah.
After something, and that was such a great button. And here's what, John Cleese was quite mad. I mean, Jonathan Winters was insane and spent time with the insane. One of the things I found over the years was that comedy is not so much a talent as a condition. It's people who are funny are dysfunctional in some way. They're kind of insane, and they're not, and they're funny for a reason. Usually it was something during puberty or or adolescence that they weren't good looking or they weren't athletic and they went to a jock school or something like that, and so comedy became their defense. And so Cleese is quite insane. And on the way back, we shot part of Rat Race in Calgary. And on the way back home, we took a car. And we're on the same flight. So we took a car together. And we're on the same airplane, sitting right next to each other. And we get to the airport, and one of these airport concierges that helps incompetent actors find their airplanes greets us and makes the mistake of saying to Cleese, "Is there anything I can do for you?" And John looks at her and he says, "Yes, I'd like a proper English breakfast before I fly." And she says, "What? Excuse me? What? A proper English breakfast? What? And he's, "You don't know what a proper English breakfast is?" "Well, you know, eggs, tea, toast, jam or marmalade, you know, perhaps a bit of bacon, you know, a proper English breakfast. That's what a proper English breakfast is. And you asked me if you could do anything for me. Well, that's what you can do for me." So she runs off and terrified.
Of course.
I looked at her and I said, "John, what the fuck's wrong with you? Why did you do that to her? Look at her. She's," I said, "I don't know. She looks like she looked like she wanted to have something to do." And that, when he was, he would play with people because if they recognized him, if they were submissive in any way whatsoever, he would take advantage of that and mow right over them, you know?
Yeah,
it's, but he was funny.
Yeah, there's, I mean, there's no doubt about that. Oh my God. Do you mind talking about a few of your own vinyl productions?
No, not at all.
Because, well, there's, I will say the one that threw me today, which I hadn't seen before, which is impossible, and I'll never own it because it's $250. It's impossible to get, which is the BBC Rock Hour special that you guys did as the McKenzie Brothers.
I don't even remember that.
Yeah, I had a feeling it's one of those that's like, maybe, you know, I mean, like Zeppelin did a Rock Hour special, but yeah, if the one copy they have online right now is $250. So you don't remember that one, that's fine, but we can absolutely talk about what I mentioned previously, which is Great White North, which is just this great meta album. Is what everybody says true about the creation of the McKenzie Brothers? Is that all from you guys? Is it all very much the Canadian content regulations, as I understand the story?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's absolutely true. And it's well told. And, you know, for the sake of your audience, I will repeat it, but it's the Canadian version of the show was 2 minutes longer than the American version because they had 2 minutes less commercial time. So the CBC said, "We want that 2 minutes to be distinctively Canadian." I was a head writer at that time, and I was like, "What the hell are you talking about? We got, you know, most of the people who are doing this show are from, are Canadian." And I said, "We're shooting this in Edmonton. How much more Canadian do you want it to be?"
Yeah.
I said, "Do you want us to just wear toques and parkas and sit in front of a map of Canada and drink beer?" And they said, "Yeah, that would be good. And if you could put a Mountie in there somewhere, that would even be better." So in some of the early Great White North that we did, there's a Mountie mug on the table.
That's right.
As a kind of a screw you to the CBC. But we did this really as a commentary on the neurotic need that Canadian broadcasters had to fulfill the need for Canadian identity and Canadian content.
Yeah.
And they were all improvised. And each one is on was 2 minutes long, because mm-hmm. that was the exact length just difference between the CBC version of the show and the US version of the show, which was on NBC and O&O's okay. that year. So well, I remember, you know, Rick and I would be getting the count. The rest of the cast would go home.
Mm-hmm.
And it would just be me and Rick, the floor director, a cameraman, and a sound guy, and the guy in the booth, the sweatshirt. And then we'd get a count in, 5, 4, 3, 2, and they point to us. And the reason I did that, I did that as a stall for us to think of something, because we would shoot 10 of these in a row.
Holy shit. Okay.
And maybe 2 of them would be good and the other 8 would just be no good.
Sure.
But from the producer's point of view, to get 4 usable minutes out of an hour of shooting
yeah.
compared to the more elaborate things that we shot with multiple sets and wardrobe mm-hmm. and costumes and things like that, that was very cost efficient. The producers loved it. So we would get a count warning us, 5 to wrap it up, 4, 3. Okay, so that's our show for today. So then some of them are very truncated
mm-hmm.
because, you know, we didn't have enough time to unwind and stop, and we just have to cut it off. So,
oh my God.
Then when it came time to do an album, because the McKenzie brothers kind of broke out of the show and actually reached out to a different audience.
Mm-hmm.
So I had wanted to do a spoken word album with the cast and had been bugging them about it literally for years.
Yeah.
And they were all too busy and nobody wanted to do it. We were doing a TV show. Why take a step back in time and do an album? But sure. That to me was important because, you know, that was part of my evolution in comedy. I had grown up on those albums and I wanted to have an album that I could point to that, hey, this is my comedy album. And
you,
so
you were then who I am right now. desperate to make one. I am now who you were then, desperate to make a comedy album. I get it, believe me.
So we didn't have any time allotted or put aside for it. So I remember Rick and I would go to this recording studio in Edmonton after shooting all day at 7 or 8 at night. Mm-hmm. And the producer there would have some, you know, McDonald's for us or something like that. Mm-hmm. And we would just have a beer and sit in front of the mic and just improv.
Holy shit.
For like 2 or 3 hours till we were so burned out we had to go to bed.
Oh my God.
We'd go back to the hotel. So I don't remember how many nights we did this for, but it was like more than one. But it wasn't a week of nights. It was like maybe 3 different recording sessions.
Wow.
And the guy who produced it was Mark Giacomelli. Uh-huh. And he was the editor on SCTV. So knew the characters and he knew the dynamics of our comedy and how that worked.
Mm-hmm.
And so Mark said, you know, is there anything you particularly want me to do in the editing?
Mm-hmm.
And I just said, no, just see if you can get, you know, an album out of this, because I don't even know if there's any shit in there that's usable. And Rick was the same. Neither of us really knew. But the only thing Rick said, and in this to his credit, Rick had been a DJ before he came to SCTV.
Oh, wow.
And he said, we got to put 2 songs on this album or we won't get airplay.
Fair.
He knew the Bill Hard report and all these kind of industry recording things that were the dynamics of how people got airplay on Top 40 radio and how people got in Billboard and Cashbox and things like that. So he knew all that, mm-hmm. and I didn't. So I said, all right, well, we'll put a... So we asked, Rick asked Geddy Lee, because he knew Geddy Lee from school.
Okay.
They'd gone to school together. And he asked him if he would come and sing on the album. So, you know, and they were just friends, that's all. But it was like the lead singer of Rush is going to come and sing on our album, you know. And we literally gave him a case of beer for his job, for doing it. You know, that was the record ended up, you know, going gold and platinum and triple platinum. And and Geddy got a case of beer. He laughed about it to this day, about how you hosed me, eh? You know, but
oh, that's delightful.
But that was how that album came to be. And I mean, no one was more surprised than us when it started getting airplay and when it started selling. And when it sold, you know, I mean, we made a lot of money on that, because one of the things I had done before Rick joined in the show, there was a guy named Hart Pomerantz, who was originally Lorne Michaels' comedy partner.
Yeah.
But he was a lawyer.
Right.
And he said to me, whatever you do on SCTV, own your own characters.
Yeah.
He said, they will want to own the show, and they're entitled to that because they're paying for it. And they'll want to own the formats. But if you own your own characters, then you can do stuff with these characters on your own if the show becomes a hit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we owned the McKenzie Brothers. So when we did the album and the movie and Pizza Hut commercials and Molson's Beer commercials and Jiffy Lube commercials and Brother Bear and
Bear
2. When we did all that, we owned it all. And nobody on the producer side got a piece of that action, you know. So it was a pretty good deal for us because, and I remember John Candy got a little jealous and said to me, you're using your position as head writer to give the McKenzie Brothers a favored position on the show. That's why they broke out as a hit. And I said, Jesus Christ, John, if I knew how to do that, don't you think I would have done it again?
Right.
I said, you know, nobody knows how to do that. That's just the way, that's the way it happens. That kind of stuff just happens. And later on, he was fine with that. But just at the moment, you know.
Yeah.
There was a bit of jealousy there.
I will say, if there's one other thing that could have come out of there, in rewatching the stuff that I can find on YouTube, a Schmengi album would have been good. I mean, to be fair, that would have been a great thing to see. I'm sad that it doesn't exist. Although I wonder if the material exists, but I also now wonder, do those tapes exist of you and Rick Moranis improvising for hours on end? Because what I wouldn't do to hear you two just fucking off drunk for hours and hours creating this album out of nothing, which I did not guess was the case.
Well, you know, that tape does, even the, I would love to have seen the Great White North 2 minute bits that didn't make it.
That was my other question. I mean, would love to see those.
But they bulk erased that stuff back and re-recorded over it.
Jesus Christ.
So, you know, there's no copies of any of it. It's all gone. You know, nobody thought about the future back then, you know?
Yeah, right. Well, again, that's why vinyl is so fucking important. You can't erase vinyl. All you can do is snap it over your knee. I have one other one to ask you about, which a kind... listener to my show named Stephen Cook sent me a while ago. He's like, have you ever heard The Wanker's Guide to Canada? And I said, of course I haven't. That sounds insane. Please send it to me. And he sent me the MP3s of it, including you doing Robert Service at Your Service, which I did not understand but enjoyed. Maybe you can walk me through it if you remember anything about it.
Nothing. I don't remember doing that.
You're on it, Rick Moranis. Everybody, I think, from SCTV is in there, if I'm not mistaken. I feel
it's
like
called The Wanker's Guide to Canada.
Yes, it is.
What, how does it exist as a CD?
It's an LP. There might be a CD. Actually, I don't know if there's a CD of it, to be honest. Let me see if I can pull up anything else that will tell you. Wanker's Guide to Canada LP from '86, if I'm not mistaken, 1986. We've got Eugene Levy, Earl Cameron, Martin Short, Catherine O'Hara, again, yourself, Rick Moranis, a few other folks on here. Oh, your brother's on here, if I'm not mistaken. Is your brother's Ian, correct?
Yep,
he's on here too. Who's on the, I'm trying to see if there are any credits that can tell me who wrote it or produced it or put it together, but that's hilarious.
Who gets credits as producer on that?
That's, let's see here. Okay, so the group is referred to as the Wankers. Writing an arrangement. Let's see if writing an arrangement tells me anything. Nope, not really. That tells me nothing. Wow. Yeah, this is there's so little information. Featuring. Yeah, of course, featuring Dave Thomas. I just said that out loud. Do we have anything on the back? There's a bunch of what look like publicity photos that were probably very much from SCTV. Does this back image tell me anything? I just love that you've also done these other records, but they are not, well, they're not your record. So, you know, no. you don't need to give a shit about that. I get that. Wow. I cannot zoom in enough to see who wrote this, but I'm going to have to dig a little bit and find out. But yeah, you're on it doing Robert Service, At Your Service, a very thick, delightful Scottish accent.
What is it? Who is Robert Service? Is he a Mountie or something?
He is a Scottish Canadian poet, British Canadian poet, but of Scottish origin. So hence the Scots accent, the Bard of the Yukon. But it is with a pop music background. And it's insane. It's insane.
I'm just looking this up. Wanker's Guide to Canada.
Uh-huh.
It's a book.
Oh, there's a book too. Okay. See, there we are. That I was not made aware of.
I don't see an album.
Yeah.
Here it is. The vinyl.
Yeah. 1986.
Oh, so Peter Alves is on this.
Uh-huh.
Peter Alves went to school with us.
Okay.
He was at McMaster. Marty Short, Wanker's Away, Earl Cameron, Catherine O'Hara.
There's a lot on here.
The Hummer Sisters, vocals, Deion Taylor, Janet Berg. I don't know who they are. Val Bailey, Eugene Levy, The Nylons, Peter Alves. Val Bailey and Ian Thomas. Rick Moranis, Light My Fire. I don't know what that is.
I'm going to have to listen to the rest of it. I mean, he sent this to me years ago, so there's no excuse for me not to listen to the whole thing.
Yeah.
I figured I would ask.
Well, I don't even remember doing it, but, you know, that's it. Not on. When I was working on I was a writer, a producer for the show Bones on Fox. Uh-huh. And when I was there, one of the guys who was one of the writer producers said to me, yeah, we worked together on King of the Hill. And I said, I never did King of the Hill. He said, yeah, you did. He said, I was at the recording session. And then he pulls it up on IMDb. He said, not only did you do it, you did six King of the Hills and you don't remember it. And here's why I don't remember it. Because when you get in a recording booth, mm-hmm. you have no visual reference.
That's fair. Yeah.
That will remind you of anything later down the line. So, and I was in so many recording booths for so many shows that it would just be a blur, you know?
Yeah.
I did The Simpsons, but The Simpsons got me to come to a table read. So I got there with everybody and Family Guy, that was different because Seth MacFarlane made a big deal out of me coming and I spent some time with him and got to know him a little. So that was, you know what I mean? But
yeah,
I think
absolutely.
For King of the Hill, I just went in, recorded it and left, you know,
yeah.
And then, you know, of course I don't remember. And I mean, I did so many animated things that I'd have friends, you know, like my friend is Tom Kenny, who's SpongeBob.
Yeah, yeah.
So Tom did this show called Duckman.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, do you want to do some voices on Duckman? And I went, not really. And he says, come on, it'll be fun. And I was like, all right, sure. So you get paid scale or like
sure.
twice scale. It's like $1,000 or $800, you know? And so it's like, back then I was making a lot of money and $1,000 was just nuisance to me. I have to get my car and drive somewhere to make $1,000. So it was usually for a favor to a friend that I would do something like this, you know?
Sure.
And so I did Duckman. Well, you know, I still get residuals for Duckman. They're only like $2 or $3, but
sure.
you know, over 30 years, that will add up.
Yeah, of course. You know? Okay, here's the thing that's still spinning around in my brain, besides the fact that your mother worked for basically what sounds like a comedy team of doctors, because one of them sounds like a straight man, one of them sounds like he wasn't. I kind of love that idea.
No, they were real psychologists. They weren't comedy guys.
Right, I know, but I'm just saying they are a comedy team in terms Zener of a straight and man and a not straight man, you know? One of them was way more off the beaten path, and the other one was a little more straight-laced.
That's right.
You know, I love that as a pairing, and I would watch that movie. But the thing about The Great White North, this is hurting my brain. I had no idea the whole record is improvised, because it's so meta. It comes with a script to play along with. It's got that bit. It's got the read-along with the record bit. It feels so well put together. Did you guys have input on the sleeve design and all that stuff too?
We when Mark cut the album together,
mm-hmm.
he would play us stuff, and he'd go, "What do you think of this?" And we'd go, "Lose that. That's not funny." You know, mm-hmm. he'd go, "Oh, I like it." And he said, "Well, you like it, but we don't, and it's our album." So
fair enough.
You know, and then we'd say, you know, that one would be good if it was a little shorter. You know, once you cut this out. And so we did have a say in the arrangement of some. And then there was I think there were a couple of holes where mm-hmm. he said it would be good if we had a thing here.
Okay.
And so we went in to record the holes. And I think that L. Ron McKenzie thing was a hole.
Forgot about that one. Yeah.
I just did, based on, it was sort of a kind of a shot at Scientology,
because
mm-hmm. I'd just been exposed to L. Ron Hubbard and the whole Scientology thing, and I just thought, how can people believe this?
Yeah.
So, cut to... Yeah. Not even that many years later, about 5 years later, I'm directing a movie with John Travolta.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
Well, The Experts.
Mm-hmm.
And I introduced him to Kelly, his wife.
Mm-hmm.
She played his girlfriend in that. So anyway, at one point I went to his trailer. I knock on the door. And I go in there, and John is holding two tin cans attached with wires to a laptop.
Uh-huh.
And I said, "Oh, sorry, what are you doing?" He said, "I'm being audited." And I said, "By the IRS?" He said, no, by Scientology. And I said, "Oh, all right, I'll come back." He said, "Yeah, I'll come back later." So when I went back, I said to him, "John, I don't get it. I mean, you seem like a reasonably smart guy, and there you are, holding two tin cans with wires attached to a computer. Talk about skip science. I mean, that makes no sense to me, you know, knowing you as I know you." And he was so good-natured and so mm-hmm. sweet. He just smiled and he said, "I get that. I see where you're coming from. But all I can say, Dave, is that it works for me." Mm-hmm. And I went, "All right, whatever." I mean, you know. My parents, my mother especially, came from an evangelical Christian background.
Mm-hmm.
And those people just used to piss me off beyond belief.
Yeah.
You know, but after a while I got more tolerant. I thought, well, you know, if some people really need to believe that Jesus is going to make all the big decisions for them and take over the direction of their life
mm-hmm.
and promise them an afterlife, I can see why that would be easier than standing on the edge of an abyss looking into nothingness and go, "What the fuck is this all about?" Which is where I was, you know?
Of course.
So then you start to get more tolerant as you get older, you know, you just kind of go, "Yeah, all right, whatever works for you, you know?"
Mm-hmm. For me, it's comedy albums, obviously. Otherwise, you know.
What's that?
For me, it's comedy albums. Yeah. Maybe that's my thing, you know, I suppose, because I can't stop connecting things.
There's tremendous comfort there, too.
Yeah.
Because you can get, you're talking about the meta. This is the, what's the opposite of the meta? The, it's like macrocosm and microcosm.
Oh, right. Yeah. So what is the opposite of meta? That's a good question.
When you're in the weeds of the actual album itself, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? When you're listening to the sort of specifics of the words and their reason for using specific, you can get lost in that and sure. really enjoy it, you know? I do.
Obviously. I mean, that I think that is one of the things about specifically Great White North that that makes it last, that, or at least makes me continue to enjoy it. Obviously, again, I was fooled into thinking it was put together from the beginning, and I love that. I love so much that it's improvised, but also the joy of you two together. Is it safe to assume that if you two were in a room together right now, Bob and Doug McKenzie could come out without a problem?
Rick and I talk at least once a week, sometimes more, mm-hmm. a couple of times a week. And we'll talk, sometimes we'll talk for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And we still have a real dynamic together, and we both know it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, sometimes you just meet people that you mesh together with so well that, you know, it's a partnership that was just waiting, two interlocking pieces of a puzzle waiting to be snapped together, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that was the case with us because, you know, we had to do, I asked him if he would do a benefit for my brother's son who got in a snowmobile accident and became paraplegic.
Oof, Jesus.
And so we did a benefit, and Rick was just, of course. So that meant we had to, like, take the McKenzies out of mothballs mm-hmm. after mm-hmm. all these years and try to revive them as old men. As old men, which is what we are.
Sure.
And we started coming up with stuff that was wrong for the show,
mm-hmm.
but would have been so right if we had still been doing the McKenzies today.
Sure.
And realized, you know, because Bob and Doug, there was a Canadian journalist who kind of got Bob and Doug. And he said, you know, they appear to be really stupid, but they're actually fairly cagey and smart.
Mm-hmm.
They've got their own kind of public access show. They figured out that 2 minutes is all that people can deal with in terms of their attention span.
Mm-hmm.
And they are communicating culturally with an audience that that was kind of ahead of its time. Mm-hmm. And later, sort of YouTube finding its kind of maximum fighting weight at about 2 minutes. YouTube pieces that are about 2 minutes have got a better shot of going viral than long.
Oh, for sure.
Or things that are too short. That's
big time.
That's enough time to develop it and not enough time to get really boring. You know?
Right, right.
So there was stuff that was ahead of its time with those two characters. And, you know, I mean, there were other characters after us, like Wayne and Garth.
Sure.
And that figured, okay, that worked for Bob and Doug. It'll work for us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Myers is a notorious material thief. So, you know, neither Rick or I were surprised when he did that.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also true, we didn't own the copyright to two people getting in front of a camera and doing a direct address. I mean, we could say that it was like the McKenzies, but it really wasn't, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was different enough that you got to let it go.
Yeah.
You got to let it go.
Yeah, of course. Of course. But, you know. Boy, I will tell you, I'm looking forward that I don't remember when we're doing it, but I have a guest coming on to speak about the Strange Brew record, which I have actually never heard, which is weird that I've not heard it, seeing as I love Great White North as much as I do. Is there anything I will have nothing to contribute, but is there anything, any memories from making that record or the movie that you think would be of interest?
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Well, right from the beginning, it was a disaster and kind of an accident. There's a piece on YouTube that you can find out. It's called Twilight Theater. Uh-huh. And it's Rick and me talking about the genesis of Strange Brew and trying to get out of it, which at that time we were both trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it started like this. We did the album and it sold.
Mm-hmm.
Then I said, well, we should write a movie. But by now the producers of SCTV were hip to us. And they said, we don't own the characters, but we own your services and your time.
Ooh.
And you can't go and do something else right now because we have first call on your time. And mm-hmm. if you do, we'll sue you.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was like, So we hired a writer, a Hollywood screenwriter, to write the movie Strange Brew. A guy named Steve DeJarna.
Mm-hmm.
And what he did was fine, but it wasn't the McKenzie brothers. It was because Rick and I had improvised it. Really, that would be an impossible thing for somebody else to just jump in, capture those voices and the dynamics, and at the same time be funny. That was a lot to expect someone to be able to do. And when we got the script back, we looked at it and we thought, oh, man, this is awful. We can't do this.
Yeah.
But our agent at the time at CAA, Jack Rabke, sent the script out on Friday to every studio. And by Wednesday, we had a deal at MGM.
Oh, shit. Okay.
So now we got a deal and we're like trying to, and Rick says, I don't want to do this. And I said, no. We don't have to do this. We can rewrite this. He said, no, they bought that other script. And I said, Rick, they didn't even read the other script.
Of course
they Trust didn't. Me. They bought the deal.
Yeah.
We have a hit record. We're on TV. They know that they can squeeze some money out of this if the budget is low enough. That I said, that's what this is. This mm-hmm. is a deal. This in show business, this is the business of show business.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I started writing on my own. I got to about page 30 or something like that. Rick came over to my house and said, let me see what you got. And he saw that I started that thing of releasing. Originally, it was releasing bees instead of moths in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in the script until we shot. And then the producer said, we can't release bees. We'll get sued. People will get stung. We have to release moths or something more benign. And we're like, well, that's not very interesting. Bees were better because, you know. But anyway, Rick saw that opening with the releasing the bees in the theater, and he laughed. And he said, okay, all right, let's do this. He rolled up his sleeves, and then the two of us went through it. So we, pre-production was already starting.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a guy who was a very famous cartoon comic book guy named Paul Chadwick,
mm-hmm.
who created a comic called Concrete.
Okay.
For Dark Horse Comics. Anyway, they hired him as a storyboard artist. So he's there and he's going, what do you got for me? And we're like, oh, shit. We were handing him like stuff handwritten to board up.
Okay.
And so we were just barely ahead. So the movie is kind of an amalgam of two movies.
Mm-hmm.
The movie that started out with us releasing the moths in the theater and trying to wreck our own movie, and the brewery with Brewmeister Smith, which was the other movie, they kind of merge about halfway through, and that's what that script is.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that great. I never thought we really did a good job.
And that's why I never understood it as a kid. My mom showed it to me. I'm like, what am I watching? I didn't not enjoy it, but I was so confused.
Yeah,
as a kid.
Well, you couldn't possibly know that, because one of the handicaps of doing a rewrite is you have the other version in your head.
Yeah.
And you think that just because you know that, the audience knows it, but guess what? They don't. So we were making assumptions in our writing that the Brewmeister Smith story was known commodity.
Yeah.
Which it wasn't. And then when we wrote Brewmeister Smith and his sidekick, Paul Dooley,
mm-hmm.
we kind of wrote them like Bob and Doug. Because that was basically what, that's how we knew how to write a comic duo. And there's one scene in particular where Max, who was a big guy and he had big hands, big, and he grabs Paul by the head. He says, I could crush your head like a nut, but I won't, because I need you. Now go to the loading dock. And I had been fooling around doing my impersonation of Max. And one day I was doing it. And then all of a sudden, it was like in school, impersonating a teacher. All of a sudden, I noticed the faces of the people that were laughing are now frozen. Okay. Like, oh, shit, he's behind me. And he was. And Max says, that's quite good. Can you do my voice for me so that I don't have to do off camera? And so I ended up doing his voice for off camera, but I'd been fooling around and I did that, crush your head like a nut. And Max came up to me and he said, that the reading that you did of crush your head like a nut, he said there was a rhythm to it that I liked. Can you do that for me now? So I'm giving line readings Amazing. To one of the greatest actors, you know, and I'm just like, holy shit, you know, it was pretty cool.
Wow. Holy crap. That's remarkable.
And the reason we got Max is we were sitting in Freddie Field's office at MGM. And Max is like, who you got in mind for Burmeister Schmidt? Because he's like, I don't know anything about these comedy guys, but a villain. I know what a good villain is. This is a studio executive.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I sort of had Max von Sydow in mind, just thinking, you know, that's a pie in the sky thing.
Uh-huh.
And Max says, Mary, get Max von Sydow on the phone. So he's in Sweden, and Max calls Max in Sweden, which back then in 81 was a big deal. You know, people didn't have cell phones. Long distance calls to Sweden were expensive.
Yeah.
Plus time zones. So anyway, Max calls Sweden, or Freddie Fields calls Sweden. He says, I got these two guys here, the McKinsey brothers, and they're hilarious. And they got an idea for, here, why don't I let one of the guys tell you about it? He hands me the phone. So I got to sell this script now to Max von Sydow. So I went through the plot in a very unfunny way and in a very laborious way. And when I got to the end, there was a pause on the other end of the line. And Max says, so it's a comedy then. And, you know, he tagged me right away with that. Yeah. You know?
Holy shit. That's delightful.
But, I mean, I had seen him at that time, most recently in 3 Days of the Condor. I mean, I knew his Bergman stuff and him playing Jesus in The Greatest Story Ever Told. But his assassin in 3 Days of the Condor, Joubert, is a really great character. And he has a speech at the end, which I was so impressed with that I could do it. And I said that to him when he came to the set the night that we were being chased out of the theater by the audience for releasing the moths. So he's there for that. And the producer said, Dave, this is Max von Sydow. He's a big guy. He's like 6'3 or something, you know. And I said, Max, I know everything you've ever done. I'm a huge fan. Thank you so much for doing this. I, you know, your speech at the end of 3 Days of the Condor, I actually learned that speech. I was so impressed by it. And he looks at me and goes, really? So can you do it for me now?
Fuck.
Well, I had to do that speech where Max tells Robert Redford that if he stays in America, how he will be killed. And we'll be going for a walk. It'll be a beautiful spring day, much like this. And a car will approach you. And someone you know will get out. Someone you trust. But they will leave open the door. And Max stops me there and he says, that was my idea. And I said, what, thinking that the whole speech or the whole image or the metaphor.
Right.
He said, no, no, leave open the door, as opposed to leave the door open, because I'm European and I would put the adverb in a different place. And I was like, okay. Okay, that was your big contribution to that. Good going, you know. But it was pretty special. I was that guy.
That's great.
In the movie.
Is there anything you would like me to promote? Anywhere people can find you? I know you're on Twitter, etc.
No, I mean, well, I wrote a book with Max Allen Collins.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very famous mystery writer. He wrote the underlying material for Road to Perdition.
Oh, okay, sure.
And he's written like over 500 novels. He's award-winning mystery writer. So the two of us, it was an idea I had for a TV show pitch, and then never sold it because it was too weird for television.
Mm-hmm.
It's called The Many Lives of Jimmy Layton.
Okay.
And that's coming out as an ebook on Amazon soon. And
awesome.
It's about a little thief from South Boston who's on the run from a Vietnamese drug lord that he owes money to. And he breaks into the home of a physicist in Cambridge, Massachusetts, who's an MIT physicist, who's doing a mini worlds experiment in his basement.
Uh-huh.
And the mini worlds interpretation was something that a physicist named Hugh Everett III came up with. Basically, the concept builds on that kind of Schrodinger's cat experiment that Erwin Schrodinger came up with, which was a way of giving people an image to help them understand how light can be particles and also waves at the same time.
Okay, yeah.
But basically, Hugh Everett's theory was that you come to any binary choice, A, B, and say an intersection, you can go left or right. The road not taken, suppose you turned left, that becomes your reality. The road not taken still exists.
Mm-hmm.
And all the choices that come from that road form another universe in the world that is the unrealized road not taken choice that spun off from that left turn.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout our lives, we have a lot of binary choices, and each time we do that, the universe splits. So the universe is a myriad of alternate universes, and in one universe, you might be this person, and in another version of your same universe, you might be someone slightly different, you mm-hmm. know? So this little guy stumbles across this lab with a quantum computer and a bunch of gizmos he doesn't know what they are, accidentally connects it and ends up being transported into another version of his life. And at the same time, he's shot as an intruder by someone else. We don't know who that is.
Mm-hmm.
This is the mystery portion of the book. And because he ends up in a coma and doesn't die, in order to stay in the alternate universe, you have to die in this one, so that the road not taken becomes the road taken.
Uh-huh.
So because he doesn't die, because he's in a coma, he starts hopping from one version of his life to another. In one version, he's like just a slightly richer version of himself. In another, he's a boxer. In another, he's a soldier in Afghanistan. In another, he's a priest. In none of these versions of his life does he become the King of England or Bill Gates.
Sure.
It all has to come from the sort of basic ballpark of your starting point,
yeah,
who you are, and what would be the kind of logical choices you might have made in that life. So anyway, two detectives are trying to figure out who shot him in the baseline reality. And in the other reality, we follow Jimmy through these different worlds that he goes to.
Mm-hmm.
It just struck me as something that might be too complicated for a TV show, but maybe as
right.
a book.
Right.
So I wrote three chapters, and then this guy, Max Allen Collins, read the three chapters and said, I like this. What do you say I write it with you? And I said, deal. I'd never written a book.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I don't know how to write it. So there'd be a learning experience for me. So anyway, we wrote it. It's coming out soon on
that's
Amazon.
Amazing. That's up my alley. That's the kind of stuff I love. That's fantastic. Well, again,
well, you will like this because
I will love it. Yeah.
You'll like this because I tried to be really true to the physics. I mean, obviously there's a point of departure, like in any time travel movie, where you have to, no matter how logically you work out your rules, you're not going to create paradoxes, or you're not going to, or you might create an alternate timeline where you don't have a grandfather, you know, because you killed him in the other, you know. Sure. But you have to obey the basic rules of time travel, or the audience will go, bye-bye, we're not going to go with you on this, you know.
Yeah.
So there's laws to quantum physics. I don't understand them all, but there's laws that I try to obey in the crafting of this and what the science of this was. And I honestly wish that Hugh Everett III, who has a son who's a rock musician, could have read this, but his dad was the inspiration. I might reach out to this guy and talk to him.
I mean, see if I,
his son, you know.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, I will read it. I will absolutely read that. I will recommend everybody else does. And just go listen to the Great White North album. It's just too good of a record to miss. You should not miss that record. Apparently, you can skip The Wanker's Guide to Canada, but that's fine. I really appreciate you doing this. This has been a delight. My cheeks literally hurt from joy. And I'm going to tell you guys, thank you for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. You can email us at podcast@comedyonvinyl.com. You can also send snail mail to Stolen Dress Entertainment, P.O. Box 805, Burbank, California, 91503. Subscribe to Comedy on Vinyl on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else you can find podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating and write us a review. It helps. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Comedy on Vinyl, or find everything in one place at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune in to the new Stand Up Records channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast. Visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, watch videos, and imbibe freely of our multimedia content going back 15 plus years. Stolen Dress Entertainment.
Hey, it's my turn. Ah!